You're listening to Radio Times Rewind. I'm Marty Moss Cohen. Toni Morrison started her literary career working up the ranks in publishing. In the late 1960s, she became the first Black female editor for fiction at Random House. She didn't publish her first novel, The Bluest Eye, until she was 39 years old in 1970. In the decades that followed, she cemented her place in the American canon with works including The Song of Solomon and Beloved, which won the Pulitzer Prize in 1988. In 1993, she became the first Black woman to win the Nobel Prize for Literature. In 2003, the year we spoke, she published her eighth novel, titled Love. It's the story of several women and their relationships with a charismatic owner of a vacation resort. Morrison called it a perfect book, which I ask her about later in the interview. But we start here, as Morrison answers my question if she had any concerns about naming her book Love.
The choice was a considered one, because there was a lot of danger, I think, a little risk in using a word that empty in a way and that cliched.
But was that a challenge for you? I mean, to take this, as you say, empty, cliched word and find some...
Yeah, it became exactly what I wanted the novel to do, is to recast that word, reshape it, and give it back its meaning, its original meaning, or complicate its meaning. So that's what convinced me that that would be a suitable title.
Well, and I should add that the original title was A Sporting Woman,
right.
But you felt as if people wouldn't quite get that?
No, and it was all sort of freighted. It's an old-fashioned word for prostitute. Right. But I wanted to suggest that it also meant women who had a little moxie, had a little courage, a little outlaw women. But it just didn't work. It didn't work at all.
And you like outlaw women?
Oh, I very much like outlaw women. I'm always in their corner.
And why is that? Just because they are rule breakers, saboteurs, which I think is one of the ways you've described yourself.
Yeah, my feeling about saboteurs is I do it only in my work. I'm very conventional otherwise, and I pretty much do what people tell me to do. But for the woman who is on the edge, not literally a lawbreaker, but kind of a pariah in the community, those women are interesting to me because the, you know, constraints of the society are so overwhelming that when they take a step out, they're doing a very interesting, creative thing, even though it may come to a bad end.
I'm curious about the seed, the spark for this story, because it's a story on many layers. It goes back and forth in time. There are characters, some of whom you're not sure if they're actually dead or alive, and I don't want to give too much away. But for a story such as this, was there something, some moment that got you started?
The idea was broad. It was a whole time span of pre, during, and post-civil rights. But that was the background. What I did in order to enter this world was to start with the scene of that 14-year-old boy who is at a party and wants very much to participate in this violence, this sexual violence on a girl.
A gang rape, really?
A gang rape. And he's new in the community. He's only 14. He wants to be a man. And without any plan, he just rescues her. He just cannot go through with it. And it humiliates him to rescue her because the other boys call him, you know, the obvious names. And he feels, because that kind of instinctive love, caring for, is a sign of weakness. Mm. In many, I said among teenagers, and somebody corrected me and said, no, it's frequently a sign of weakness among adults.
Was this a news story that you read or something out of your imagination?
No. I just thought about this feeling. I raised two sons. And they weren't very much help in this area, although I have to say I asked them about that peer pressure to do things that you know are wrong. And he is a sample, as are the children in the main characters who, when they were children, of a kind of unsullied, pure, unpolluted human instinct toward reconciliation, toward love, toward caring, and how that gets diffused or corrupted is the rest of the story.
I found it so interesting that it was set in a black-owned resort, a vacation resort, which, as you describe, and I'd love to have you actually read a section from it, is it was known as the best and best-known vacation spot for colored folks in the East Coast. And and there were real resorts like this.
Yes.
And I guess this was the days of segregation.
Oh, yeah. Well, under those circumstances, a literal apartheid situation, there were not only entrepreneurs like Bill Cozy, but there were first-rate schools, there were law schools, medical schools, concentrating on developing a professional class for the race. And I knew of some of these places around this area, you know, sort of near the Midwest, Lake Erie. There are many in New Jersey, some in the South. Some of them very classy and very exclusive. And they evolved into other things. But most of them, like many of those black institutions, collapsed when African Americans had choices. They could move anywhere, they could go to other schools, etc. So on the one hand, I wanted to suggest the benefits of that movement, but also to suggest the losses.
Well, I'd love to have you read a section from your new book, Love, a new novel, and this is in part what this resort was all about.
Yes. Who would have thought that in the teeth of the Depression, colored people would want to play. Or if they did, how could they pay for it? Mr. Cozy, that's who. Because he knew what a harmonica player on the street corner knew. Where there was music, there was money. Check the churches if you doubt it. And he believed something else. If colored musicians were treated well, paid well, and coddled, they would tell each other about such a place where they could walk in the front door, not the service entrance, eat in the dining room, not the kitchen, sit with the guests, sleep in beds, not their automobiles, buses, or in a whorehouse across town, a place where their instruments were safe, their drinks unwatered, their talent honored so they wouldn't have to go to Copenhagen or Paris for praise. Flocks of colored people would pay to be in that atmosphere. Those who had the money would pay it. Those who didn't would find it. It comforts everybody to think of all Negroes as dirt poor and to regard those who were not, who earned good money and kept it, as some kind of shameful miracle. White people like that idea because Negroes with money and sense made them nervous. Colored people liked it because in those days they trusted poverty, believed it was a virtue, and a sure sign of honesty. Too much money had a whiff of evil and somebody else's blood. Mr. Cozy didn't care. He wanted a playground for folk who felt the way he did, who studied ways to contradict history. But it had to be special. Evening dress in the evening, sport clothes for sport, and no zoot suits. Flowers in the bedroom, crystal on the table, music, dancing. And if you wanted to, you could join a private card game where money changed hands among a few friends, musicians, doctors, who enjoyed the excitement of losing what most people couldn't earn. Mr. Cozy was in heaven then. He liked George Raft clothes and gangster cars, but he used his heart like Santa Claus. If a family couldn't pay for a burial, he had a quiet talk with the undertaker. His friendship with the sheriff got many a son out of handcuffs. For years, and without a word, he took care of a stroke victim's doctor bills and her granddaughter's college fees. In those days, the devoted outweighed the jealous, and the hotel basked in his glow.
And that's Toni Morrison reading from her new book, a novel called Love. Cozy is such an enigmatic, charismatic figure in this story, and the circle of women around him, each of whom has a different relationship with him, a different idea of who he is. How did you conceive of him?
I started out thinking that he was a simple man, greedy, perhaps, certainly ambitious, a good time fellow. But as I proceeded, he became much more complex than that. He had generosity, but he was licensed. He had power. He had wealth. He could act on a whim that other people couldn't. And he had this enormous, you know, presence. And his affect on the women around him was tremendous. Mm. And they were all sort of jockeying for places. And he did indeed ruin most of their lives. But my feeling was that they were complicit in that. If they couldn't think of anything better to do than to rearrange their relationships with each other based on what they thought would be his approval, he authenticated them in some way. And that led to this terrible, terrible relationship among them.
Well, and I love that passage. There's just so much there to think about and talk about. But this notion of money, how white people looked at black people with money and how black people looked at money themselves.
Oh, yeah. It's a kind of a depression complex where, you know, when I was growing up, rich people had to explain themselves because we all understood that whatever they did, they probably got that money dishonestly. Mm. And it might be a form of denial, but I have to say that in those days you could be both poor and an adult at the same time. Now you can't. If you're poor now, you're a child.
Because you're treated like a child.
You're treated like a child. You're told where to live, where not to live. You're given food or food stamps. You're provided for, and you have no dignity whatsoever. It is as though it is your character flaw. And that was not the way people in my generation, who were also poor, grew up. Because you could do things to prove that you were an adult. You took care of your family. You could build a shack. You could, I don't know, fish. You could do things that suggested adulthood.
Are you saying, I mean, this is more, I guess, political, sociological question, but are you saying that the safety net, the war on poverty, all these programs to help poor people has turned poor people into children?
No. I think people need help in many instances. And before the so-called safety net, there were other people. There were neighbors, there were churches, there were other people who, without being asked, would step in. I'm not saying the safety net has stressed that. The neighborhoods have shifted. There really aren't any blocks left in many places like that. So that why not have the government provide the kinds of things that human beings used to do willy-nilly? And also there were a lot of people who fell through the net, so to speak, who just never made it, where the collapse was just devastating, and it didn't have to be that way.
I wonder, too, and this is not to bring back segregation, certainly, but some have said that in the days of segregation, you would look at a neighborhood and it was just so diverse that you had teachers and doctors and economists living side by side with people who hadn't finished high school.
True.
And that there was a kind of vibrancy that's really missing today.
Everybody went to the same barbershop. You knew each other. And the neighborhood was close. The community was close. And you knew things that you would not know when you dispersed into other places. That's a valuable thing. Mm-hmm. But on the other hand, it's the kind of thing that every group that came to this country had to figure out. What was valuable about walking into the mainstream and so-called climbing, and what you lost in terms of your culture, your own language, for example, some of the other habits. And African Americans went through the same thing, just, you know, belatedly, where there were some marvelous freedoms that we were able to achieve. But at the same time, like anything else, it has a cost. My position is, I just dislike the either-or situation. Why do you have to have only integration, forced integration, or acceptable integration, and to deplete all black schools? Why can't you have both? I mean, one does in terms of private colleges, but it could have been a little broader, I think.
You grew up in a town in Ohio called Lorain?
Yes.
Yeah. Was this an integrated town or...
Oh, yeah. I thought the world was like that.
Really?
Where there were Polish people and Czech people and Mexican people and black people. Our connection was that we were all poor. But as far as race and ethnicity, it was a huge mix. I mean, it's one high school in that town where we went. Mm-hmm. There were separations, religious ones, you know, there were churches and, you know, societies for each of those ethnic groups. But in the streets and in the stores, I thought, I mean, I've never lived in a black neighborhood or never lived in a street in which there were no white people or other people. So it was when I left and went to Washington, D.C. in the 50s, it was a huge, you know, alteration in my concept of how people lived in this country.
Was that your first experience with this thing about race and racism? And
it was in that sense, in the legal sense, right, where you had four colored-only signs on the public transportation in Washington, D.C., and where there were places downtown where you could not go. What I remembered are the places where, as a young black girl and my classmates, were able to go to certain restaurants because we knew we could use the facilities there. And everybody, it was like an underground railroad. You knew the one or two places where they wouldn't put you out.
And since we're talking a little bit about your growing up, your parents, it sounded like you came from a family of readers and also a family of storytellers. And,
oh, very
and even
much.
Ghost stories.
Oh, especially, ghost stories. Those are always the best kind. They were rural people in their childhood.
Right.
And my grandmother, my great-grandmother and on my mother's side, and that's the way we entertained ourselves.
Pre-TV, right? So what you would, I mean, I'm trying to imagine, sit around the kitchen table or the dining room table and tell stories.
At any time of day, they told them. And then the interesting thing, I think, for me, is that we were asked to tell them. So we would repeat stories, and they would listen very carefully at our delivery. We could change them a little bit, alter them a little bit, emphasize them a little bit. But we were called upon to do that kind of thing at a very early age.
Well, I've read, too, that you talk about your writing, that it needs to work out loud, or you think of it as speaking, I guess, perhaps more than writing. I'm not sure if I'm saying that correctly, but is having this storytelling tradition help you think about stories as something that need to be heard?
Yeah, I think that my writing has to work quietly on the page first. But if you can hear it as well, I try to make it oral, you know, kind of a sound, which has a narrative storytelling quality to it. And when I read sometimes from my works, people say that they hear different things. Mm-hmm. They read the book, but upon hearing the reading, you know, they understand it differently or more clearly.
Well, I like that idea of being quiet on the page. Are you a quiet writer?
I mean, I don't hear anything. I'm a very quiet writer.
No music, no.
Oh, no.
No.
No competition and no seductions from other, you know, like scenery or music or anything. This is the place where I am in control, where I am the most free, where everything is either very comfortable or very dangerous, but it's mine.
Hmm.
So I don't want anything else in there while I am reigning over that territory.
So is this a cell that you work in without windows or any adornments?
Oh, it's an absolutely stunning room I work in, but I don't look.
But you don't look. Those are the distractions, right? Well, I do want to talk a little bit about two of the women in this story, this novel that you've written. And one is Cozy's wife, Heed, whom he marries as, I mean, she's a child. She's, what, 11 years old. And his then granddaughter, who's basically the same age, these two girls who become women living in this house, Christine. And you write about their feelings for each other, a hatred so pure, so solemn, it feels beautiful, almost holy. This is a physically combative, emotionally combative relationship. And as I read about it, I thought, gosh, I know marriages like that, where people are really, they're just locked in a lifelong battle with each other.
Oh, yeah. Several people have said to me things like that. You know, when I read about the relationship between Heed and Christine and that silent hate that freezes them. This one woman said, I thought about my parents. And another one said, well, you know, I had a friend who said he hadn't spoken to his sister in 20 years. There are all sorts of frozen relationships like that, where no one has the language or the will or the interest to break it, just stop and hope and encourage the other person to open up as well.
And yet you're right along with age. This is talking about these two women, recognition that neither one could leave played a part in their unnegotiated ceasefire. More on the mark was their unspoken realization that the fights did nothing other than allow them to hold each other. Their grievances were too serious for that. Like friendship, hatred needed more than physical intimacy. It needed creativity and hard work to sustain itself.
Oh, yeah, you have to work to sustain hatred. And it's true, you're locked together almost like lovers, the reverse side of lovers. And in fact, it is a version of what they had before. That's that pure, when I say holy, it almost has the status of love when you, you know, put it that way. And that's true about nations, it's true about sects, it's true everywhere. You see this obsession with the other. Now, if that isn't the opposite of love, I don't know what is, because otherwise you just walk away.
Right. Because in so many ways, the book is this exploration of the dark side and the bright side of love.
Oh, yeah. I wanted there to be many ranges, or a wide range, rather, of love, from the one we described with that young boy, a sort of, he doesn't even know what he's doing when he follows his instinct. Right. To the sort of subterraneous, corrupt loves of, say, Mr. Cozy and his mistress, the young girls who just fell in love, and the raw lust, carnal relationship between Roman and a teenage girl named Junior.
Yeah, yeah, and they're just doing it everywhere, aren't they?
That's appetite.
In fact, I mean, the beginning is a kind of soliloquy where this character Elle, she was a cook, I guess, when this resort was in its heyday, and you know, she's just moaning and groaning and grumbling about all these sex
terrible
crazed
women.
Young people. Was she speaking for you at all? I was just curious.
No. In some instances, perhaps, but not about that. That's a little. She's very judgmental about that. I feel sort of mournful about the imposition of sexuality on children, not just assaulting and interfering with them, but just dressing them up, and they're all being required to look like mini sexual objects. It's troubling. Mm. It's troubling because they're focusing then on one kind of relationship with another human being, and that's a sexual one, instead of the woman that you comment on, Elle. She has another kind of love. It's very wide.
Yes.
It's probably celibate. She is not limitless in her approval. She judges very harshly, but she doesn't condemn. And she calls it, it takes a certain kind of intelligence, she says, to love like that. But I wanted the reader to sort of experience and touch the varieties of ways in which human beings can relate to each other in a nonviolent way.
I read somewhere that you have described this book as perfect. And I think another novel you described as perfect was Jazz, and I thought, ooh, that's bold.
I thought everybody was going to laugh when I said that. But there's something about love that reminds me of my work with Jazz a lot. Yes.
But what does perfect mean to you?
I mean, it doesn't mean anything. After I get through writing them, I feel very accomplished. And then I start reading them aloud in public, and I begin to see all sorts of things I want to change constantly. You know, it's never, ever perfect. And I thought that was very funny, but other people took me quite seriously.
That was Toni Morrison speaking to me in 2003. In just a moment, we'll be back with more Radio Times Rewind, including how she says she became okay with making mistakes as she got older.
I feel that profound kind of liberation that I certainly didn't feel when I was in my 30s and 40s.
This is Radio Times Rewind. I'm Marty Moss Cohen. Let's get back to my 2003 interview with novelist Toni Morrison. We start here talking about how she uses humor in her writing, including her lauded novel Beloved, and what comedy means to the Black experience in America.
Particularly when you're in a deeply and powerfully oppressed situation, laughter returns the agency to you, to yourself. So even in Beloved, there are moments, scenes when Setha's behavior is just so outrageous, the guys fall out laughing. Yeah. She's going to kill everybody that comes up. You know, it's ridiculous, it's outrageous, and it turns tragedy into something that you can kind of manage. It's a technique to protect yourself.
Kendra from Lumberton, New Jersey, joins us this morning on Radio Times. Kendra, go ahead. You're on the air.
It's an honor to speak to you and hear you, Toni Morrison.
Thank you.
I've been a big fan for years. My question is, in the book, in your books, you often honor the dead and make them living characters in your work. And I was just wondering, and I think you may have answered this, but is your inspiration from all of the wonderful ghost stories that were told to you, or is it something else?
Partly that, and partly also the way members of my family talked about their own relatives who were dead, as though they were there, and they were very, you know, powerful and exciting people. But technically it was about something quite different. I just didn't find naturalism or realism, which is a form that many African-American novelists have perfected. It sort of wasn't big enough for me. I really wanted to push it out and identify a magical, interesting world that was affected and was just outside the real world that we live in. And it just gave me breath. How could I say history is every day in your life if I had not brought back someone from the past, a dead person who has a claim, who sits down at the kitchen table and says, now you have to deal with me. So it was helpful to me. It offered me so much wider territory.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Kendra. That's a great question. Rachel from Center City, Philadelphia joins us. Rachel, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi, good morning.
Good morning.
Marty, good morning, Ms. Morrison. Can you both hear me?
Yes,
indeed. Yes, good morning.
Oh, this is really an honor. I'm thinking here of a question, and I have such a short amount of time, and I don't know where to begin. So the question is, and the thought is, Ms. Morrison, the magic that you bring to millions of our lives is profound. And it's inexpensive. We can get it in the library. We can get it at the bookstore. It's very spiritual for me and for many of us. As a selfish human being, how do I get to taste a piece of that magic and offer it to other people on a daily basis? I know this is a pretty big question. How do you experience it? Maybe that's a better way of asking.
And this is this great sort of creative impulse you're talking about,
just
Rachel?
Just the moments, you know, life can be incredibly depressing and morose and all of these things. And I want to experience little bits of spirit here and there.
Sure.
Yeah.
Well, what are your thoughts? It is a big question, Toni Morrison, but I'm curious what you have to say.
I think of life as big. It's very big. People sometimes complain about my work, and when they say your characters are too large, they're not normal, they're not cut down to domestic size. But I see people that way. They look complicated to me. They look interesting to me. And so do the everyday things. Perhaps it's, you know, being in my 70s now. But I imbue everyday actions, I used to think, with a narrative, but it's not that. It's just living those moments completely. And when you encounter other people, you don't need an agenda. All you need to do is just to relate to them pretty much the way you would like to be and look people in the eye and tell the truth or withhold other things.
Interested in what you were saying to our caller about thinking, I guess, in a sense, thinking large, thinking beyond the sort of day-to-day humdrum of life. Is that something that you've always done, or is that something you've come to with age? You are 72, and whether there's a certain kind of freedom to think so expansively.
I think I always did. From a very young age. Right? I thought everybody did. And it was interesting to me, even as a young teenager, to realize that some people thought of their lives as very small, small in feeling. And it wasn't so wide as it was deep. And then as I, you know, grew up, I understood more about the restrictions and the necessities for sacrifice and hard work and so on. But nevertheless, life itself was just this interesting, extraordinary, and always surprising event, one after the other. And of course, as I grow older, I'm 72 now, I feel that profound kind of liberation that I certainly didn't feel when I was in my 30s and 40s, when I can make mistakes.
And it's okay.
And it's all right.
But was that something your parents gave you, this sense of seeing, as you say, feeling things largely, deeply?
Yeah. My mother, I think, especially. She was a very shrewd, realistic, hardworking woman. But she looked at the world as though it were there for her. Unlike my father, who was, you know, very overwhelmed with the consequences of racism in his own life. My mother just judged everybody one person at a time. Hmm. And her, you know, her first gesture was always open. And if she ended up not liking you, it wasn't because she didn't give you a larger chance to do the best. And she found people's lives interesting. Not in that gossipy way, but kind of a shaped way. Hmm. And I think that's what was passed along to us, to her children.
And she was she had a good singing voice, too,
right? Oh, yeah,
she
was a fabulous singer.
Sang in church,
sang in church, sang at home, you know, played the piano, as many of them did in my family. They never could read music, but they were sort of instinctive musicians. As a matter of fact, when they sent my sister and me off to take piano lessons, we were humiliated because we thought we had a defect. We had to be taught how to play the piano, and they just picked it up. I didn't know that they were trying to give me something like the ability to read music.
Right. Can you sing? Do you have a singing voice?
No, no. I can't carry a note.
Really?
No, no.
Any of your siblings able to sing?
I think so. They're musicians. Yeah. They play beautifully, both of them.
Let me get to Bob from Mount Airy to join us. Bob, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi, good morning.
Good morning.
I recently read an interview Ms. Morrison did for O Magazine, and there was a very powerful quote there that I'd like to quickly read and perhaps get your comments, Ms. Morrison.
Mm-hmm.
Go ahead.
She says, "I tell my students, when you get these jobs that you have been so brilliantly trained for, just remember that your real job is that if you are free, you need to free somebody else. And if you have some power, then your job is to empower somebody else." That was very powerful for me, and I wonder whether you could just say a few words.
Oh, I believe that very strongly. I don't know what it's about if it's not about expanding itself, reproducing itself in others. If you know anything, you pass on the knowledge. And if you have anything, if you have any excess, you share it with somebody. Mm. And I was speaking, I think, in that moment particularly to women, because there's such a, you know, such heat in trying to get to a certain level. And there were some who were very much gatekeepers and didn't want to share their space. So I was encouraging them to think along those lines, and I still believe that.
Bob, thanks for calling in.
Thank you.
Sure. Is that part of what teaching is about?
Teaching is
very much
like that.
And you've done a lot of that.
Yeah. And I was just telling a guest you had, Madeline Albright, that she said, there is a special place in hell for women who don't help other women. And I reminded her of it just outside the studio.
So that that resonated
with
you?
Oh, yeah.
When
I heard it, it's exactly. She said, "I know you agree with me." I said, "Absolutely." Absolutely.
And again, Toni Morrison, our guest today on Radio Times. She's got a new book, a novel called Love. And if you want to give us a call, 1-888-477-9499. I read a quote, and this is really about writing, and you early on you said, when I first began to write, I was a little breathless because I wasn't sure that a particular expression or sensibility would be there tomorrow, and one can panic under those circumstances. Then you learn that, yes, you may forget the perfect sentence you thought it in a traffic jam. It may not come back, but then you realize it doesn't matter because a better one will come. I would think realizing that as a writer has got to be so liberating.
Oh, yeah. It's very hard to get that across to students. They think they're trained, the first shot is the best. But revision and rethinking that's the biggest part of it. But in the first book, I was clutching every clever or what I thought was beautiful or well-turned phrase and in a panic when I lost it. And then I had to find something else. But the process of finding something else meant, first of all, you had the confidence that it would be there,
yeah.
And it was. And more often than not, it was much, much better than the one you had been, you know, clutching and hanging on to and trying to remember. It's an important part of the art process to know that.
Well, and I wonder, too, because you worked as an editor, whether
yes.
that's something that you also learned, because editors have to tear things apart and
oh, sure.
rework
yeah.
language and toss things
right.
out and be, I guess, tough on a writer that's so married to their language.
Well, in many instances, particularly novices sometimes, some people don't need that. They have really good eyes for their own work. But often the problem is to pull the writer away from what he loves. And the slogan or the word in editing is, if they love it, throw it out.
Oh, really?
Probably it's a very subjective, ill-placed. I've had moments like that in which my editor says, I would say, he would, you know, sort of doubt the clarity or the work in two or three sentences. And I would defend them and say, no, this is pure whatever.
It's perfection.
It's perfection. And he would say, yeah, but it's not hers. It's yours.
Oh.
You know, when your own voice slips into your character's voice, and you force their language to become yours, and you're not speaking the character's language, you're speaking your own. Those instances are rare, but they do happen, and sometimes you don't see it because you just love the way you said it. You love your own language, and that has got to be, you know, it leads you into an area that can only breed tears when you begin to just love it for its own sake. That's bad.
Well, and Robert Gottlieb, I assume, is the editor that you're talking about. And he's been your editor for some time
yes,
now, right?
Yeah.
And that must be such an interesting relationship, a long-term relationship
yeah,
between a writer
yeah.
and their editor.
He was with me from the second book, went away to edit The New Yorker for a couple of books, and now he's back, and we work together on Love.
Yeah.
But that is special when you have what is really the right editor for you. May not be the right editor for somebody else. And it's a question, I think he put it best. He said, we read alike. So that's pretty much it.
And as an editor yourself, I'm curious about how you nurtured, I guess, writers that you thought had talent, and then what you say to ones that maybe have one book and maybe that's it, or just don't have what it takes. Is that?
Well, some people have one book, and that's all they have, but maybe that's enough.
Yeah.
You don't have to write just because you can. And there are others who are probably not going to be. Those I don't really see because you can reject
right.
them right away.
Right.
The difficulty is in when you have students who are in and you have to do something, and even though they don't expect to be professional writers, they're in there to learn something. And that's when the editing that I had done comes in. Because I can line edit their work, word by word by word, and teach them the value of reflection and rewriting and revision. But, yeah, you're in a position where you say no, and you critique constantly. But the trick is to do it in such a way that it's always about the work and never about the worker.
Oh, interesting. Do you like all parts of this process, then?
All of it.
The writing, the rewriting, the editing.
The manufacturing.
Do you?
Oh, yeah, the paper.
Really?
They won't let me do that now that I'm only an author. But when I was in publishing, oh, that you know, interior design, book design, fabric.
You're down there?
Oh, I love it.
And how much? This is a kind of a, what's that color?
Oh, I'm not going to tell you. We worked very hard to get that color.
It's a great color. Yeah, it's brown nice. And red. And but that was important for you.
Very important. We fought.
Can I ask you something? Because you were born with a different name, Chloe Anthony Wofford was mm-hmm. the name that you were born with. Does anyone still call you Chloe?
Oh, yeah.
In your family?
Oh, yeah. They all do. My nieces, my sister. Mm-hmm. And I always know who those... If somebody says Chloe, they're either one, somebody who knew me a long, long time, or they're those hideous telemarketers who've been looking at, you know, the phone book or something. Hi, Chloe. Hang up right away.
So I guess a Nobel Prize doesn't keep the telemarketers away, does it?
No, it doesn't.
but you changed it because I guess Chloe was an unusual name in the 50s?
People misspelled it, mispronounced it. Mm-hmm. And when I was a freshman in college, somebody began to call me Tony, and I thought, oh, that's great. We'll just leave it like that. Although I have to tell you, I was really miserable because I didn't change it on my first book. I really never planned to have Toni Morrison on the book.
This is Beloved?
No, this is The Bluest Eye.
I mean, The Bluest Eye. I'm sorry, yes.
The first
Bluest
book.
Eye.
And I was, you know, just had come into editing, just got this book done. And I was going to use Chloe, and I was going to use my maiden name, Wofford. And I thought that would be not even a nom de plume. It would be my real name. And then the name in editing was Toni Morrison. Mm. And I sent it off, and life went on, and the Library of Congress cataloged it. And I thought it was too late. But it wasn't, but I thought so.
Yeah, but Toni Morrison works,
so
too, I
it works.
Guess.
That's the nom de plume.
That's your nom de plume. You've written books with one of your sons.
Yes.
Slade?
Yeah.
Is that his name?
Slade.
Books for children.
Right.
What's that like to work with your...
That was a trip. I mean, I had written two books based on his comments when he was a kid. And then together we got excited about rewriting Aesop and updating it and making it sort of pertinent and getting rid of those terrible morals that were at the end of those stories. And particularly, he was incensed about the ant and the grasshopper. Mm. Why were they upset about the grasshopper? He was an artist. He was a musician. Why wasn't he worthy of getting help? But the relationship is, wonderful. That we have, but it was tough.
I bet. Let me get Nick from Malvern to join us this morning on Radio Times. Nick, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi, Ms. Morrison. Thank you very much for taking my call. I really respect literature as an art.
Thank you.
And you as an artist. My question is, a little earlier, you mentioned that your parents were musicians, and I can really sense that in your voice and the tilt and the rhythm of your voice. My question is simply, do you recognize any elements of music as have a... taking an important part in the creation of your works. And I'm talking about the development, recapitulation, tempo, dynamics, form, melody, rhythm. The list can go on and on. I see quite a correlation. Do you?
Well, that's interesting.
I do. I always say that I don't want to compete with music. That I don't want to be seduced by it. I want the language to be its own thing. But I do know that there are musical qualities. There is rhythm. There is rest. There is space. And there is a quality of sound that I work very hard to achieve in the work. I don't know if musical is the appropriate word, but it'll do until I can figure out something else, because I really do want a certain sound, a kind of spokenness in it, and that requires nuance, beat, rhythm, and so on.
Well, I know you've written a libretto for an opera, Margaret Garner.
Yes.
Yeah, based on this Beloved character, right?
Yeah. I was attracted to doing it, although I normally don't like to go back over because topics that I've exhausted. But Richard Daniel Poor wanted to do it based on the historical Margaret Garner as opposed to the one that I sort of plundered for my novel. But the other thing that was interesting to me was I think there are too few operas that sound right or good or beautiful in English. We generally hear them in other languages where they're terrific, or they're translated into English and we don't really care because the music is so gorgeous. But when you read the libretti by itself, it's very disappointing. So I thought if I could do the language of these people in language that is vernacular but beautiful and poetic, not Porgy and Bess, that language sounds awful to me. The music is great. The opera is great. I mean, the opera. But when you, Bess, you is my, I mean, what? Sorry about that. But I wanted to work in another, you know, arena and make it sound beautiful.
That was my 2003 interview with novelist Toni Morrison, who died at the age of 88 in 2019. Joining me now in studio is WHYY executive producer Kevin McCrory, who's been helping me sort through the archives to make this Radio Times Rewind series. And Kevin, nice to have you back with us.
Always great to be here, Marty. So Toni Morrison. What a giant in the world of literature.
Indeed. And I have to say I was a little nervous and I figured I'm going to get one shot at interviewing Toni Morrison. She's not going to be coming back, you know, on a regular basis. So I wanted to really do my homework. And I think I actually took the day off before so that I could read through her book and come up with an interview that hopefully spoke to the moment and spoke to some of the themes that she's been dealing with as a writer.
There was one part that stuck out to me. You know, she talked about outlaw women.
Yeah.
And you kind of zeroed in a little bit on how she kind of writes about these people on the fringes who maybe don't do the things that society expects them to do.
Right.
Is that something you relate to?
Oh, totally. I relate to that. But interestingly, she says that those are her characters and that's her interest. But she says, in my own personal life,
right,
she's kind of not conventional, but she doesn't live as an outlaw. I really like, and it's often when you interview a novelist, I've found over the years, is you can't really do a book report because for the most part, listeners haven't read what it is we're talking about. So I'm always looking to sort of pull themes and ideas out of the book, and hopefully the writer can talk about the writing process. Not all writers can do that, but she really could do that. She knows, I mean, clearly, she knew exactly what she was doing and why she was doing it.
And she talked about that, you know, that whole idea of this like black-owned resort and kind of black wealth at the time. And there was a really interesting back and forth you guys had about, like, I guess the concept of wealth.
Yeah.
And her recollection was like in an older era of America, you know, you were looked at suspicion if you had wealth. And there was more dignity in being poor, and maybe you were able to provide for your family in other ways. And her telling essentially was that changed over time.
Yeah,
did that resonate with you?
Well, I think raised some questions because the government came in and helped people out of poverty, but that changed neighborhoods and people moved out and who stayed behind. So it's a very interesting take on our racial history and how she lived it and how she wrote about it.
Right. And I guess she talked too about like not even just the black experience, but kind of the immigrant experience of starting at a certain part of the culture. And as you climb the ladder, what you lose in your culture to be able to make that ascendance. And that seemed to be a big part of what this novel was about.
Yes. I wanted to say something about her voice. Mm. Because it's such a rich, resonant voice. She talked about her mother being a singer and a musician. I think some members of her family also were that as well. But it's interesting in this Radio Times Rewind, we've got Lauren Bacall and her very distinctive voice. With George Carlin, we talked about his voice as well. And what you hear in her voice is just this sort of rich, almost like velvety quality. And her reading, I thought, just sort of spoke to the power of storytelling.
Absolutely. Yeah. And with all the examples you just provided, which we've been going through in this series, the voice kind of gains a gravity because in each case, it's like an artist who has refined their point of view.
You're right.
Knows exactly what they're trying to say and has gotten to the point that when they speak it, they speak with such authority and and gravity and power.
And I think a lot of these people that we're interviewing in the series are older. Many of them no longer with us.
Right.
So they are at a point in their career where you can look back on it. You've got experience. You've been successful. I mean, there's a kind of freedom that comes with all of that.
And she talked about aging in terms of being more comfortable with herself and being able to make mistakes.
Right.
Do you?
I totally relate to that. As an older person here in the room, yes. I mean, I hate making mistakes, but at the same time, you know that that just comes with life, with the things that you do, the things that you care about. That is going to happen, and so you forgive yourself, I think, a little bit more. But personally speaking, no, I don't like making. I have to be perfect,
right?
Like the rest.
But were you harder on yourself, like in your 30s, your 40s?
I'm always hard on myself. I mean, that's sort of part of my nature to be super hyper critical. I think it's funny, coming up, you don't know what you're doing so much. So you sort of forgive yourself in a certain kind of way, but also hold yourself very accountable. Now I feel like, well, I should know what I'm doing, so I shouldn't be making any mistakes. So it's kind of a double-edged sword there.
Yeah. I loved her talking about her writing process as well.
Yeah.
And just like being kind of locked into the typewriter or the computer, right, whatever it is. Like, and her talking about that's her place where she feels total control.
Yeah.
Even if it's dangerous.
Yeah.
You know, she's in control. And that was just very cool to kind of hear her talk about that. And also the revising process and her having been an editor and really understanding the power of going through multiple drafts and getting feedback and whittling away. You know, murdering the darlings, right? That's the Hemingway quote.
Yes.
She talked about basically, if you love it too much, that's what has to go.
Exactly. Which, ouch, you know, that's got to hurt. And also that it needs to be quiet.
Any final thoughts on Toni?
Well, interesting. She mentions Madeleine Albright, and she's going to be our next guest on Radio Times Rewind. And this was a day when when Radio Times was 2 hours a day, my first guest was Madeleine Albright. The second guest was Toni Morrison, and they passed in the doorway, both in studio, and Toni Morrison mentions this, but it truly happened, where Madeleine Albright said famously, apparently she said it a million times, that there's a special place in hell for women that don't help each other. So, words to live by.
And Toni reminded her of that.
Yes, exactly. And they both had this moment at the door. So.
That's amazing. All right, well, we have something to look forward to next week now.
We do. We do. Thanks so much, Kevin.
Thank you.
Radio Times Rewind is a WHYY special series on Sunday evenings. Kevin McCrory and I are the executive producers of the show. Our engineer is Charlie Kyer. Next Sunday, my 2003 interview with Madeleine Albright, the country's first female Secretary of State. Kissinger said, "Welcome to the fraternity."
That was very funny because he hadn't even known what he said. And I said, "You know, Henry, it's not a fraternity anymore."